I cannot wait to share this conversation with you. Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of the Open Minds Podcast. Today's episode is very special. It's my third conversation ever since I started the podcast with the thoughtful and insightful Judith Curry. Welcome to Open Minds. It's the podcast that attempts to explore with genuine curiosity the world's most intriguing issues. Some topics include climate change, gun control, basic income, and so much more. I invite guests on who are both proponents and detractors of these issues so that we can be exposed to more nuanced perspectives we may not be hearing. You can find me at openmindspodcast.com or anywhere you stream music. I'm your host, Christopher Balkrin, and welcome to Open Minds. When I first started my podcast, climate change was one of those topics I always wanted to explore because I just felt that no one really knew what the future was going to be. And despite our modeling and whatever we can do today, it didn't make countries more immune to the effects of climate change. And what could actually be done? What could we possibly think of to help our societies into the future? It's this existential crisis that I don't believe any other civilization really thought of. I can't imagine that ancient civilizations thought about the world in 2023, nor would they. It's beyond the level of comprehension. Yet today, when it comes to climate change, we're routinely thinking about the world 100, 200, 300, 400 years out and thinking about public policy in relation to that. So when I started my podcast, I found Judith Curry, who's an American climatologist who has been criticized for criticizing the United Nations IPCC, or Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, and some of their modeling. We've had such great conversations. In fact, where I'm recording this is the same place I recorded our first conversation so many years ago. And I had a really terrible internet connection and had no idea about Zoom and Teams and all that. But it's so amazing to see the growth, both in terms of the podcast, but in terms of my understanding of climate change. Judith has released a new book called Climate Uncertainty and Risk, and we spend this conversation talking not only about the limitations of global climate modeling, but then we get into what can be done. And Judith shares very interesting case studies from the developing world, specifically Bangladesh, about adaptation. And adaptation, to me, seems like perhaps the best way forward. How can we actually create technologies to adapt to our changing environment? I hope you enjoy this. As always, let me know what you think. All my conversations with Judith are my top rated, top downloaded, top listened to podcasts, and I hope this is no different. Check it out at www.openmindspodcast.com. Follow me on Instagram at openmindspod or on TikTok at openmindspodcast. I hope you enjoyed this conversation. Professor Curry, this is our third conversation together, and I'm so excited to have you on the podcast. We've covered so much in our previous two conversations. This one will focus on your new book called Climate Uncertainty and Risk, which I personally am absolutely loving reading. We're not going to go into all of the details that we have in the past on climate modeling and some of the challenges there. And I'll leave links below for people who want to explore that. But I want to start with chapter 8 of your book, which begins with, global climate models are inadequate for predicting regional climate change and the frequency and intensity of extreme weather events. The direct use of climate model output in regional adaptation decision-making is inappropriate and produces an inflated impression of confidence in estimates of future changes. First, why do you think we rely so much on global climate models to dictate our public policy?
Well, people were looking for, they scientized this whole thing right from the start. Yeah. You know, they were looking for you know, some scientific finding to provide the answers to very complex societal issues. And they were looking for some sort of technocratic solution. And climate models seemed to be ideally suited, you know, bigger, complex international teams and the world's largest supercomputers. And it just had sort of an appeal. But it became, you know, and like in the 1990s, the grand poobahs of the World Meteorological Organization and the UN thought, oh, well, we can reduce uncertainties in the climate models and improve them. But as they added more and more stuff to the climate models, you know, the uncertainties exploded. I mean, the minute they started adding chemistry, you know, ocean chemistry, atmospheric chemistry, then this became a much more complex problem with many more degrees of freedom, all sorts of additional feedbacks. And, you know, it just became increasingly complex and harder to evaluate, harder to verify, and but people still became, you know, were very attached to them. But now we're seeing the hegemony of these big global climate models sort of being diminished. I mean, even the most recent IPCC report, the AR6, realized that more than half of them are running too hot. And so they made their projections. They culled certain climate models and say, you know, well, we're going to go with these. And everyone's talking about these simple climate models, these climate emulators and things like that. So the reliance on the big climate models is increasingly diminishing, which is, I think, a good thing. They're amazing tools for, you know, scientific research, but not for trying to fine-tune policy decisions.
You know, Professor, I remember reading research on human behavior, and the more complex you make a topic, the more anxiety people get. It's like the law of large numbers. I think there's only so many numbers our brains can actually see or compute at a time, and then anxiety starts creeping in when we can't really understand the breadth of the issue. Do you think it's the same with climate change, where they made these very complex models, and because it was so complicated, many of us couldn't wrap our minds around all of it, so we gravitated towards these very simplistic political slogans of solutions and the way forward?
I don't think it was the climate models that caused that piece of it. I think it was people, you know, it was the UN framed this to be a very simple problem. Okay, in terms of we're emitting CO2, CO2 warms the planet, warming is dangerous, let's get rid of CO2 emissions. And they thought they could make it something, you know, into a really simple problem, something like, oh, red dye number 2 in our food supply, you know, is bad. Let's get rid of the red dye number 2 and then everything will be fine. They were treating it like, you know, a simple problem like that. And like, it is so totally not a simple problem. It's not a simple dose response kind of issue.
Yeah. Professor, you know, in the modeling, one thing that I found interesting in your research was the omission of volcanoes and volcanic activity, or at least the underplaying of volcanic activity and the devastation that has to our climate and to our atmosphere. Why do you think that was the case? Do you think it's because it's less frequent? And if it were to be included, it would have such a shock to all the climate modeling as a result. And so omitting it perhaps is the more statistically significant thing to do.
Okay. The mandate from the UN is to focus on dangerous anthropogenic climate change. So all modes of natural variability were just given short shrift, and it's just sort of background noise. It goes up, it goes down. You know, volcanic eruptions happen. We can't predict them, so we're not going to really pay much attention to them. So, I mean, the rationale, the IPCC AR6 did pay some attention to volcanoes. The previous one paid essentially no attention. And if you go back to like the early 1800s, there were three huge volcanic eruptions, you know, bigger than Pinatubo. Mm-hmm. And they had a substantial impact on the global climate for decades, you know, and this sort of prolonged the Little Ice Age for some decades owing to these volcanoes. The biggest one, Tambora, that it was the year without a summer, you know, crops failed all over the world and it was very cold. I mean, these, especially when they're clustered, can have huge impacts. And a lot of this, and the IPCC AR6 does acknowledge if something like that were to happen again, that would be a big game changer and fundamentally change the trajectory of 21st century climate. Okay, but that's hidden in the fine print. I mean, you know, it's not out there at all, you know, what people are talking about. Yeah. And, you know, I was at a, I was testified at a congressional hearing a couple of months ago, the budget committee, and Senator Whitehouse, oh, so you think volcanoes are going to save us from global warming? You know, I think volcanoes are something that are not sufficiently focused on, and we should consider these scenarios along with, you know, the various warming scenarios. But it's like, you know, a new talking point for the climate deniers, volcanoes are going to save us, you know, and like, it's just so dismissive.
It really is.
Of recent history.
Professor, for those that don't know, can you showcase what a major volcanic eruption would do to our climate or to our atmosphere as a result?
Well, okay, if we saw a repeat of what was going on in like the first three or four decades of the 19th century, we would see temperatures drop about a half a degree centigrade for a period of several decades.
Wow.
That's pretty big.
That's, wow. And we don't talk about that.
Oh, no, I don't talk about it.
Jeez. And what would that mean to our oceans, to our wildlife, to our modern climates?
I mean, it's a big jolt to the Earth system. I mean, volcanoes, I mean, bigger ones, I mean, the ones in the early 19th century were big, but they were not insanely large. There was a really big one in the 13th century, Somalis, which was, you know, incredibly huge. And it's hard to even imagine. We don't have any historical records of what was really going on back then. But apparently there's an enormous one like that once or twice every 1,000 years, you know, over you know, the history that we've been able to deduce. So, I mean, the point is the natural climate system is very complex. It holds a lot of surprises, and to think we can ignore all that and then just talk about CO2 emissions as dominating our 21st century climate change. Well, if that's the way we're thinking, we're setting ourselves up for to be very surprised, I think.
Professor, you know, in chapter 12, you introduce this very fascinating acronym that I wish more academics would use, which is called Decision Making Under Deep Uncertainty, DMDU. I really thoroughly enjoyed this discussion because I feel like it's not just in climate change, in so many other areas where there's so much, there's this deep uncertainty, yet there's these decisions that are being made. I love the model and adapt notion that you put forward, as well as the limitations of a cost-benefit analysis. When it comes to a climate change, can you talk a little bit about some of the limitations to a cost-benefit analysis when we're thinking of what policies we should pursue?
Okay, well, the idea of, cost-benefit analysis has been introduced into the climate deliberations to justify, to say the damages from fossil fuel climate change are so large that it justifies expending what we have to do to transition our energy system. So that's the idea behind it. In order to do this, it depends critically on the so-called damage function. You have to assign a damage function, and then you have to assume to what extent extreme, I mean, it's largely driven by extreme weather events, and you have to, you know, essentially assume that all bad weather is caused by fossil fueled emissions, which of course isn't the case. So the damage function, I mean, it depends critically on the damage function. And the other, and it depends on the sensitivity of the climate to CO2 emissions. And even the IPCC acknowledges that there's a factor of three uncertainty in our understanding of that. So that's if amazing. It's on the low end, it's no big deal. If it's on the high end, it is a big deal. And then the third thing is the so-called discount rate. And this relates to how much we should spend to protect future generations. And I use an example in the book to illustrate this. Okay, so we're thinking ahead to 2100, which when I wrote the book, it was 78 years hence. Okay, if we look at 78 years ago, 1944, okay, in the final throes of World War II, how much would we expect our forebears to be worrying about us in 2022? I mean, really, right. I mean, they could not have, okay. I mean, look at all the political, they would never believe that the European Union could exist, that China would be a superpower, that we have 8 billion people on the planet living in less poverty, that the number of, or the percentage of deaths from extreme weather events has dropped through the floor. And this is not to mention all the technologies. I mean, we've had men on the moon and supercomputers and quantum this and all the household appliances and the warfare, you know, all the medical advances. They never could have foreseen this. And we look back and we don't blame people back then for what is happening now. We said, well, they did the best they could. That's history. Okay. But somehow, looking forward to 2100, we're supposed to anticipate what the world is going to be like, what their preferences are, and on it goes. I mean, at most, we should try to leave our grandchildren, great-grandchildren, a legacy of peace, prosperity, and freedom. That's about all we can hope for. Spending so much money right now trying to anticipate what they're going to want and need in the 2100 when even the worst scenarios looking forward, people are going to be much better off, you know, by four times or something, 400% than we are now. I mean, so it just makes no sense. Yeah, we don't want to, you know, totally destroy the environment, but the environment is resilient. You know, it bounces back. You know, we need to do what makes sense. We need to look forward in a visionary sense. You know, how do we promote, you know, prosperity and well-being, you know, as we go through the 21st century, while at the same time, you know, protecting resources and the environment and ecosystem. We have to balance all that. I mean, that's the big challenge of the 21st century. But, you know, we want to look forward with new technologies and all of this. We don't want to rush to tear down our electric power systems and put up wind turbines, you know, that are really going to be much, you know, our energy supply and security is going to be much diminished. And if the track record so far is any indication, it's also going to be much more expensive. I mean, so why are we doing this? Sure, let's envision a new energy system infrastructure for the 21st century that's more abundant and clean with new technologies, nuclear this and all that kind of thing. I mean, that's what we should be doing rather than rushing to meet these arbitrary targets that are just going to hurt us now and certainly not going to help anyone going forward.
Professor, there's so many nuggets there that I'd love to pick up on. First, I've noticed climate anxiety amongst my friends, colleagues, coworkers, specifically when it comes to having children. I've met many women who've told me they do not want to have a family because of the environment and the climate that they'll leave their child to. That's a real concern. And I've never experienced that before, where people are making family decisions on the basis of climate change.
Well, a couple of issues here. First, in some countries, their population is just cratering. Mm-hmm. I mean, South Korea is probably the worst, but many European countries, China, I mean, populations are declining. Yes. I think you need to have 2.1
replacement rate
children, for replacement. But like, I think South Korea is like at 1.1, and China's way below that. And Japan, Italy, many European countries are way below replacement. Even a lot of the Asian countries are now at replacement, Bangladesh and Vietnam and stuff like that. I mean, they were huge, huge population explosion before. Pakistan is still really high. Many of the African countries are extremely high. But right now, these are the people carrying the load for population. Yes. And, there's two ways of thinking about population. Is one, the Malthusian view is that, there's too many people. This is what's causing all the problems. Then there's another view is, we want to at least keep it at replacement because we need, as the population ages, we need younger people to do the work and pay for all this. And then there's a third vision, and this would be Elon Musk. We need a lot more people, increase the chances that we're going to, find another genius like him, kind of thing. It is what it is. But some of these countries are really hurting, like Japan and South Korea. I mean, the populations aren't that big to begin with, but they're just cratering, and they're not particularly... They don't have a tradition of immigration like in the U.S. I mean, we don't have any problem keeping our population up because, immigration, so many people want to come here. But, that's the problem. Okay, so now we get to the young adults who don't want to have kids. Mm-hmm. Well, they've been, the marketing, the propaganda of this whole climate issue that's been fed to kids and young adults is just obscene. Absolutely obscene. It's much worse than what I see just going through my normal news channels. I mean, the stuff that's targeted at children and young adults. I mean, even at ages 3 to 8, the book Greta Thunberg's World, Greta wonders why she should go to school when she has no future, because of global warming, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Even Greta's been recanting lately. I heard her when people were calling her out on stuff that she used to say. She said, that was all just metaphors. Mm. Okay, exactly. but the propagandists turned it, into something very literal, used to frighten children and young adults. And it's just unconscionable. Mm-hmm. The decision to have children, is never simple. In the U.S., there isn't sufficient support. I mean, there's all this anti-abortion stuff. Then if people have kids, can you please support the children and support the parents? Well, they don't do that either. So that's the worst of both worlds. So we need, a society that, nurtures children and supports the families. In order to do that. So there's a difficult lifestyle and economic decision that needs to be made in the in the absence of the support. And some of the European countries, they provide a lot of support, but certainly not in the U.S. So that's correct. Part of the issue. And then there's this fear, you know, what kind of world am I bringing them into? Well, yes. The world is going to continue to get better unless we do something to really, really screw it up, that's like right. destroying our electric power infrastructure or something that's like right. that.
That's right. Yeah. No, you're totally right.
So, it's very disturbing. But it's so pervasive, you know, amongst children and young adults, this kind of, oh, yeah, well, the world's not going to be around in 30 years and, you know, climate change. You know, I mean, you know, it just makes no sense. At some point, you know, people will look and, you know, cry, you know, call bullshit on the whole thing and start distrusting authority.
Yeah.
And this is why people end up supporting Donald Trump.
The extreme, right?
I know. They get pushed to the other extreme. So, right. you know, this is, I think a lot of the communicators and so-called propagandists are backing off, realizing that this would do more harm than good. Even the Extinction Rebellion is backing off on their really crazy stuff, you know.
Yeah.
Stop Oil is still at it. But people are saying, you know, no, this isn't the way to go. You know, we need to do something that's more constructive and not destructive.
Yeah, and I think that we all have a role to play, thankfully, with this podcast. Just having more thoughtful, informed conversations, I think, is the way to inject the public square with what we all, like, you know, sometimes have questions about and have a safe space for it. You know, here in Toronto, you're right, we have the opposite problem as Japan, South Korea, and China, and many Asian countries, where we are, under Justin Trudeau, we're accepting 400,000 to 500,000 new immigrants over the next few years, our largest amount ever. And we don't have enough housing. So housing prices here in Toronto, Vancouver, and Montreal are just skyrocketing. Rents are going up. And there's this, in Toronto here, it takes 32 months for a typical housing project to be assessed and granted access by the City of Toronto. So it's a very challenging time. And I wonder what global migration will be 50 to 100 years. But at the same time, my mind can only conceptualize the next generation. It can't conceptualize what 2100 is going to look like.
Yeah. No, it's hard to imagine. I'm sure the world will be in a much better place than it is now. Like I said, unless we do something really, really stupid, which I don't rule out, but hopefully.
Yeah.
You know, the scope of whatever we might do won't be so wide as to really mess things up. But, you know, I'm a techno-optimist, you know, and I like the enthusiasm of the human spirit and the ingenuity. Yes. And, you know, if governments can behave sensibly and mostly get out of the way, then I think we can be fine.
That's right. Professor, I want to spend the bulk of our conversation talking about something that, again, I gravitated well in this book, which is dynamic adaptive decision making. It was introduced in chapter 12 and then later discussed in chapter 13, where I am, sadly, now I understand the future chapters are even better. But I want to talk about this because there was this interesting stat you emphasized at the beginning of chapter 13, where you say, we produce enough food on this planet for 10 billion people. Our agricultural space has enough for 10 billion people. Land use has only increased by 8% since 1962, but agricultural productivity has increased over 300%. And to me, that's an example of dynamic adaptive decision-making, where we're stuck with the land we have, but how can we be more productive on the land that we do have? Why do you think this is not being discussed more, about this human ingenuity in what we have versus trying
the whole idea, adaptation, was considered a dirty word until about maybe 10 years ago, because if we were able to adapt to all this, then there'd be no reason to punish the evil fossil fuel companies. A lot of this is really about anti-capitalism, punishing fossil fuel companies and stuff like that, an agenda that doesn't really have to do much with human well-being, the environment, or prosperity, frankly. It's just a you know, political preference.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. It's terrible.
Yeah. So any good news, nobody wants to hear it. Adaptation was a dirty word. I mean, Al Gore, he recanted in his second book, not The Inconvenient Truth. He says, well, I was mistaken to dismiss adaptation. We need to adapt as well as to reduce CO2 emissions. But I think everybody pretty much realizes now that we need to adapt, but nobody wants to pay for it. And towards the end of chapter 13, when we get into development, you know, how, like how do we help underdeveloped countries deal with all this? Well, all the money that used to go to helping them develop economically and reduce their vulnerability to extreme weather and whatnot, all that money is now tied up with restrictions related to renewable energy. Okay, you know, it's not being spent on what they really need. I mean, they want grid electricity. You know, you can't develop, you know, an economy without, you know, a serious economy without grid electricity. You know, solar panels on your house only take you so far. So they've been hampering development. And, you know, I say to UN officials, well, we can't let Africa develop its own fossil fuel resources, because then we're going, you know, if we give air conditioners to everybody in India and Africa, you know, we'll blow the CO2 emissions through the roof. Okay, so instead, what they do is they exploit the fossil fuel resources in Africa and export them to Asia and Europe to support their air conditioning and their whatever. So it's just absolutely, they call it energy apartheid, green colonialism, you know, there's all sorts of names for it, but it's just flat out evil.
Wow.
You know, so what's going on is just obscene. So, you know, back to dynamic adaptive decision making and the other decision making frameworks that I introduced into the book. The fundamental premise of my argument is that we're dealing with a wicked problem, amazingly complex, ever expanding, you know, with disputed values and all sorts of issues, and that there is no fix. I mean, we can ameliorate things to some extent, but we can't control it. I mean, we can't control the climate. And every solution, you know, has unintended consequences, and on it goes. So what you do is you do your best to understand it and to manage it. And in trying to manage this, you want to do this in an adaptive way, so that you learn, you know, you see how things are playing out, and you take advantage of new technologies and so on. So, I mean, that's the idea of the adaptive. You know, once you see how the sea level rise is going, I mean, if you can do this incrementally and try to keep up with it, you know, have a big plan, but you don't execute unless certain triggers happen, things like that. So that's the idea behind dynamic adaptive decision making.
Professor, you know, in the book, you use an incredible example of what Bangladesh is doing with cyclones. I wanted you to talk about that for those that don't know, because I think this is such a powerful example of a country that used an extreme climate event and built an infrastructure around it that supports so many local economies.
Okay, so if you don't know the history of Bangladesh, this used to be East Pakistan. And following Cyclone Bola in 1970, an estimated 500,000 people were killed. Okay, wow. And Pakistan did nothing to help. And so then they split off from Pakistan and formed this new country, Bangladesh. And it was just the poster child for poverty, misery, everything that was just awful in the world for humans. And this even penetrated my own teenage sensibility. Beatle George Harrison was having these concerts for Bangladesh to raise funds for Bangladesh. And so even as a high school student, I was aware of all this. But Bangladesh, my company with my colleague, Peter Webster, I'll give you this example. We became involved with Bangladesh around the year 2000, when we were engaging with some scientists and people in the World Bank, and we had some ideas for predicting floods and hurricanes and storm surge that would give people a bigger lead time. Okay, so, and they embraced this project. So many of these, you know, so we developed a forecasting scheme, and it was very challenging because India wouldn't give Bangladesh any stream flow data. So we had to estimate what was coming through for the Ganges and the Brahmaputra so we could make these long-term flood forecasts and things like that. And these forecasts we coordinated through a boundary organization with various village leaders who had a cell phone so that they could get communications, and at prayer meetings they would discuss the forecasting. And it was this amazing, it wasn't just about the technology of our weather forecast system, it was the social aspect of communicating and the community being informed and discussing and making decisions. And so the main adaptation, if there was going to be a flood coming, a tropical cyclone, the farmers would pack up their seeds and any important belongings and walk with their cattle to higher ground to protect themselves. I mean, you know, and, you know, a big part of the farmer's fortune is wrapped up in their livestock, okay, and they were able to save their livestock. You know, if they lose all that, then they have to take out loans, and there's this endless cycle of impoverishment. And just these simple little things really help save lives and help them protect their belongings. And, you know, the Bangladesh, you know, it was so much, you know, we were working with people in India and other countries, but it was so easy to work with the people in Bangladesh because they really wanted the people to be better. There was no hubris about, oh, our forecasters are better than your forecast. They just wanted things to be better. Okay. And we did a technology transfer, our models and everything, so they could take it over. And, you know, this was just one little piece of the puzzle. But what I saw about the Bangladeshis is that they respected their poor people and they wanted to help and they wanted to be better. And, you know, they took advantage of World Bank and aid money where they could. But they also made, you know, they developed their own fossil fuel resources and they used them to develop their local economy. And you know, they're now, you know, their life expectancy is now approaching, you know, European and U.S. life expectancy. They're now a middle income country. They are no longer the basket case of the world. And it's an amazing success story. Vietnam is following in their footsteps, you know, and you're seeing little pockets of success. And the key element is good governance. You know, if your leaders are corrupt and just siphoning off all the money, you know, this is not a good thing. But it's an amazing success story, and we're seeing it replicated in other parts of East Asia, which is wonderful. So we need to really understand the dynamics here better and to see, you know, and they didn't follow the advice from a lot of the UN people, you know, don't develop fossil fuels and all this kind of thing. Instead, they did their own thing. They knew what was right, and they pulled it off. So
that's amazing.
Yeah. So it's a inspiring story. So fossil fuels really helped them, you know, get over the hump. So it's it's a good story, one that we want to see replicated, of course. But
what was unique about Bangladesh's cyclone strategy in utilizing fossil fuels to help protect those most vulnerable in their country?
Yeah, well, they put in, you know, these barriers, these polders that help, you know, keep the sea level rise and the storm surge and flow, you know, manage the water flow and whatever. And they cultivate wetlands and try to have this, you know, help their local environment. And it's helped empower women. Okay, a key to their success has been empowerment, education, and empowerment of women. So, I mean, it's a really good model. And it, like I said, is essentially being replicated in Vietnam and some of the other East Asian countries.
Professor, you know, one of the aspects of this dynamic adaptive thinking is planning to fail safely. And that is, again, something for politicians with four-year terms, there's like, you know, it's death to them. They're thinking, no, we're not going to fail. But for public policymakers, they're thinking, I'm assuming, that this seems like the most pragmatic way, because we need to, if this is to fail, we should try to fail safely. Can you talk about some steps governments can take in undertaking dynamic adaptive thinking to fail safely?
Okay. Well, robust decision-making underpins all of this. You know, it's like, okay, going back to the red dye number two example, you know, you get rid of red dye number two, there's not much of a downside. you use beets or something for food coloring or whatever. You know, there's not much of a downside. Everybody can agree on that. But when you're dealing with a complex problem, okay, you target a single solution. If you undershoot or overshoot, you know, you're in trouble. If you use up too many resources, you know, in this solution, then you don't have any money left over for a better solution. Or what if a bigger problem comes along? So, you know, it's you need to really develop solutions that are robust for a bunch of different outcomes. And you need to be able to do these things incrementally, so that you don't lock in infrastructure. You've put so much resources into this, you're sort of stuck with it, and it's not a solution that's going to work, and you're locked into it. So a big part of operation, a big part of adaptation is what I call operational adaptation. It's what you do when something bad is going to happen. Like a big flood, something, a dam is going to be breached, you know, a hurricane's coming or whatever. Like, what do you do before, during, and after that event so that you minimize the harm? And the example that I gave in the book was basically Florida hurricanes, and this relates to Florida Power and Light, which is the local electric company, and the extreme lengths that they have gone to fail safely and to rapidly restore power after a hurricane. So a lot of this is just about your operational procedures, imagining a worst case scenario, stress test your system, figure out a plan. You know, just don't wait for it to happen and then clean up the mess. I mean, that's not a very good strategy.
Professor, in this chapter, you talk about maladaptation, and it refers to the adverse outcomes of an otherwise seemingly, again, a good in theory idea. It ties back a little bit to our discussion at the top of this podcast about, you know, wind turbines and things like that. Again, in theory, sure, let's pursue a clean energy strategy, but maladaptation is something we should really talk about and be at the core of our discussion as well.
Go ahead. Well, okay, maladaptation is when you do, and a lot of these big World Bank, UN kind of projects that are supposed to, these big infrastructure projects that are supposed to make things better, often make things worse. Like if you put in an example, and this is far from the worst example, but it has so many dimensions that I think it is a good example. This is like desalination plants. I mean, off the coast of Australia, they had a huge drought, the so-called millennium drought, and you know, water resources were tight, and they really couldn't farm, and so they developed plans for offshore ocean water desalination plants, and then a big pipeline to pipe, you know, the water to other regions. And they implemented this, and of course, once they finished building it, then the rain started, and then floods became more of a problem. But you know, it's going to get dry again, okay, and they'll have these plants. So why did I use this as a maladaptation example? Well, the pipelines cut through Aboriginal lands, you know, sacred lands, and they were intensely opposed to it, and it was extremely disruptive to the Aboriginal communities. So that's never a good thing to do. The other thing is people were, during the drought, they were capturing rainwater and planting xeriscape plants and really trying to, you know, putting in low flush toilets and really trying to minimize their use of water. And so they were restricting all that. And so once they had the desalination plant, they just stopped doing all that. You know, these were good things to do. And the other thing is everybody's water bill was raised because supporting the desalination plant is expensive. And of course, that hurts the poorest people. Because at the end of the day, everybody pretty much uses the same amount of water. But a bigger fraction of their paycheck is going to be going to go to it. And also it uses a lot of electricity. So if you're worried about, you know, clean electricity, this isn't a good thing either. So it just shows all these unintended consequences. And they're sort of locked in to, you know, the desalination idea. It's probably not a bad plan for Australia, because it's the driest continent in the world, and South Australia is the driest region. So I think having desalination plants is a good plan, but you have to take a great deal of care as to how you do this. You have to work with communities. You have to, so you're not adversely impacting. You don't want there to be negative incentives like, oh, the other thing is now that they have water, more people are moving to these very dry regions, you know, which is, you're creating a moral hazard now that there's water down there.
Of course.
Okay. Yeah. So, you know, a lot more thought has to be put into these things, and you have to try to imagine all these unintended consequences and try to do things incrementally so you can learn as you go and you not sink a huge amount of resources into something that's going to turn out maybe not to be so great and lock you into a certain path for many decades.
Professor, I wanted to end our conversation with a discussion on India's cooling strategy, which I found really fascinating. Can you talk about their cooling strategy in the years ahead?
Okay. In like April and May, before the monsoon kicks in, the temperatures in South Asia can get pretty insane, you know, up to 45 degrees centigrade, you know, which is, you know, like 100, can't do the Fahrenheit conversion, but 115, 120 degrees. It's hot, you know, and it's miserable. And a small fraction of Indian households have air conditioning. In India has made leaps and bounds. This is another country that's made leaps and bounds in the last decade. They are now completely electrified. They have, you know, their economy is booming. They have recently surpassed China in terms of the largest country with the largest global population. I mean, India has a lot of issues, it has some wealth. It does have electricity. It has a real economy. Okay, now the challenge is to air condition, provide people with air conditioning so they don't suffer so much. I mean, the strategies for keeping cool, they have tile floors. So if you have like a ceramic tile floor in your house, if it's ever hot and you just lay down on it, you'll see that it has a very cooling effect. And, you know, and also water, you know, just immersing yourself in water. But, you know, you can't beat air conditioning. So it's not so much a central air conditioning, but they have all these, you know, window units. And so they're trying to, they say, oh my gosh, this is going to blow the carbon budget. You know, if you put in a window air conditioner in the home of every citizen of India, it's going to blow through the carbon budget. Well, you know, I'm sorry, you know, when people in the US and Europe stop using air conditioners, maybe we would have, you know, the moral high ground to tell people in India they can't use air conditioners. So the idea is to, well, how do we make them more efficient? Okay, so the Indian government put out, you know, a competition for people to develop strategies to have air conditioning that uses a lot less electricity. And so I know they've selected finalists, and as far as I know, those technologies are being, you know, further explored and attempt to commercializing, you know, but that's, I mean, it's absolutely immoral to say that people in India can't have air conditioning, especially when they face those horrendously hot temperatures, like in the 2 months before the monsoon. The monsoon's late this year. Okay, so the heat is just like extending longer than it normally does. So, you know, we need, you know, if the goal is human flourishing and thriving, I mean, this should be our top priority. And, you know, we don't want to hurt, we want to help people now, we want to help development, and, you know, stop focusing on what people in 2100 might want, you know, in a world that's going to be so different that we really can't imagine with any kind of meaningful insight as to what they're going to want, what they're going to need. So,
you know, Professor, you know, it's so fascinating talking to you, because I feel like this conversation about worrying about what's going to happen 78 years from now wasn't even a topic in 1944. It was much more, let's think about what the next 10 to 20 years, let's get out of war, let's rebuild our economies, let's think about what our next generation looks like. And yet there's been this shift towards thinking 100 to 300 years into the future. And to me, one of that is we've built this very safe environment and very peaceful world that our minds are naturally gravitating to something to just destroy it and cause conflict and havoc as a result.
Well, you're right. 30 years is about the right time scale to worry about. I mean, this is the lifetime of a lot of our infrastructure. It's something that we can foresee with some kind of, you know, some kind of plausibility. So looking ahead the next 30 years is, I think, where we should focus. You know, where do we want to be in 2050, you know, and how can we get there? And this whole idea, you know, even if we were to somehow miraculously eliminate all fossil fuel emissions by 2050, you wouldn't notice any change in the weather and the climate. Maybe by the 22nd century, you would notice some change, but natural weather and climate variability is so large, you know, it's going to keep doing its thing, you know, with maybe some little incremental kick from global warming that you really wouldn't notice on a day-to-day, year-to-year, or even decade-to-decade basis. So, you know, this is not where we should be focused.
Professor, the last question I had for you, and it's a kind of a little game in many ways, but, you know, there's these major international meetings, Copenhagen and Scotland and everywhere else. And of course, like, you know, a lot of critics say, well, you're, you know, world leaders are flying in on their private jets and they have 70 plus car motorcades and they're lecturing the rest of the world on the environment. But putting yourself in the position of a leader of a major G7 country, what would your message be to the rest of the world when it comes to climate change, and what countries and the global community should start adapting and doing?
My message is to live your best life, you know, to try to think about your relation to your environment, you know, and not be stupidly wasteful. You know, the people who are stupidly wasteful, you know, if you pick anybody who's flying in a private jet, I mean, that pretty much qualifies as for being in the club of the stupidly wasteful. You know, live your best life and be optimistic and try to do your part, you know, to make the world a better place. And, you know, all of this will come together. But, you know, we want freedom, prosperity, and we want peace, and we want our environment to provide the ecosystem services we need, and we want nature to be there for us to enjoy. You know, and be, you know, this is what we should be going for. And, you know, sure, who wouldn't want more abundant, cleaner energy, you know, that's better for the environment, that's inexpensive, that's in free? Well, you know, let's go for it. But wind and solar, sure as heck, is not the solution. Not the solution. I mean, generation four nuclear sounds great. The advanced geothermal energy sounds great. There's probably a niche role for rooftop solar, people who like the personal autonomy of, you know, of knowing that they're in control of their, you know, microgrids. There's all sorts of cool technologies that are being developed. And, you know, 30 years from now, there'll be stuff on the table that we're not even thinking about. So let's, you know, I'm optimistic that this is not going to be a big problem. I think Bjorn Lomborg puts it, this is a moderate problem in a sea of both small and large problems. You know, this is a moderate problem. It's a it's an ongoing, you know, how we deal with weather and climate, it's an ongoing predicament, I think is the best way to summarize it. I mean, it's not something you upend, you know, our entire world governance, our electric power, agriculture, transportation systems. I mean, we didn't even get to the part where they're messing with the food supply, you know, and Dutch farmers, you can't, you know, the Dutch are the second biggest agricultural exporters in the world, a little tiny country. Every inch of their land is cultivated and productive. And then they're, you know, the Dutch farmers are protesting. The tractors are all out in the streets. They're not allowed to use nitrogen fertilizer, and they have to get rid of all their livestock over, you know, methane farts, you know, and on it goes. It's just beyond insanity. And I mean, this is not how we move the world forward, and it's not how we promote human flourishing and thriving.
And it's an attack on everything that's what makes us human, which is curiosity, intellectual thinking, and adaptation. And I think your book has really shed light on that. And it's given me so much hope that there are so many voices like yours out there saying, let's make sure our policies are reflective of our natural curiosity, but also our adaptation and our adaptability and our ingenuity. So I can't thank you enough for not only coming on this podcast for the third time, but also for your insatiable curiosity and tireless work in this field, Professor. It's such a net benefit, I think, to humanity as a whole.
Well, thank you. That's so nice to hear. And I'll just say my new book, Climate Uncertainty and Risk, the publication date is June 6th. So it's next week. It's available on Kindle, PDF, paperback, and hardcover book. And I look forward to getting people's feedback and to just reshaping the dialogue on this whole issue. I'm hoping my book in some small way can you know, just give this whole issue a bit of a kick in a different direction.
Thank you, Professor. I will be promoting it to everyone I know. I cannot put it down. It is a great book. It is a great read. And I just think there's so many interesting conversations that'll come of it. So thanks again for coming on. I really appreciate your time.
Oh, thanks, Christopher. It's always a pleasure.
Thank you so much for listening to another episode of the Open Minds podcast. I'm your host, Christopher Balkrin. And a reminder, you can find me at www.openmindspodcast.com, on Instagram at Open Minds Pod, or on TikTok at Open Minds Podcast. Feel free to leave a comment, like, or follow. Send me a message. Let me know what you think of this episode, and I will definitely catch you in the next one.